But so you sent an email, Frank, that you know, you were listening to the material and you were enjoying it, it sounded like.
Yeah, a lot of background. I mean, I'm fairly familiar with Sankhya. You know, I read Ishvara Krishna's, all that, and, you know, I kind of delved into some of the scholarly work around that, but this is...
A whole nother realm
of
it.
Yeah, it's another level. What's up?
The Sankhya Karika is non-theist Sankhya. And so in the non-theist Sankhya, they leave out just any concept of divinity. The basic premise of non-theistic Sankhya is, like, prove God exists. You can't do it. Prove God doesn't exist. You can't do it. You can't prove it. It's like either way is unprovable. So since it's unprovable, why discuss it? You know what I mean? Like, in order for us to be scientific here, we don't need to discuss God. Like, you can't prove God exists. You can't prove God doesn't. You know, you can say, well, like this or that. And then you could say, well, is that God? Is that, you know, chance? Is that, you know what I mean? There's so many different, the arguments go in multiple directions. But that's the basis of non-theistic Sankhya. And so they end with, God is unproven. So we're not going to discuss it. And really, if we look at the Buddha, I'm pretty sure that... You know the Buddha studied with a Sankhya teacher for 6 years before he went off on his own, right? Yeah, so he studied with a Sankhya... He was in a Sankhya school. And... Which lets us know that, you know, what we see in Sankhya Karika is only the tip of an iceberg, because we spent 6 years studying it with this teacher and all that. There had to be, you know, like multiple more levels of depth and everything. But you know, his whole approach to God was, God, you better focus on your breath. You know, like that's so sometimes they call Buddhism atheist, but it's non-theist. It's not atheist. And
have you looked at any of I don't want to say Hari Harinanda, but it's this guy who wrote the Yoga Sutras. He wrote a pretty well known exposition on the sutras, but he's also like supposedly like brought back the Sankhya as a system of like practice.
And you're not talking about Baba Hari Das?
No. I can go grab real quick. Yeah, Hari Harinanda Aranya.
No, I haven't heard of him. Let's see.
No, it's this copy of the sutras, but
I have that.
He's got a whole.
Yeah,
got a whole bunch of like Indian only texts on just Sankhya and like history and like practices to work with it and like all sorts of kind of interesting stuff, but. Mm-hmm. Not the theistic side of it, though.
Yeah. But still, there's so many more practices that aren't in the actual text. But I have that version of the Yoga Sutras. It's one of, I haven't read it probably in 15, 20 years, but that used to be one of my favorites.
Mm-hmm.
It used to be one of my faves. I'm slowly bringing my old school books from the East Coast here every time I visit my mother. So that was one that only recently made it over. All the way on the end of the shelf with the yoga there. But yeah, so this is Bhagavata Sankhya. You know, this is theistic Sankhya. Mm-hmm. And when we look at, you know, Vishnu Purana... Bhagavad Gita, we look at some of the Pancharatra Shastra and Tantras, we see they're all using, and even Charaka Samhita. If you look at the Sankhya in Charaka Samhita, it is not Sankhya Karika. It is completely a Bhagavata, it's a theistic Sankhya in Charaka, which I find quite interesting. So why are they using the Sankhya Karika, a non-theistic Sankhya, to teach in the Ayurveda schools when Charaka himself was not coming from that style. But life. All right. we left off. We were talking about Purusha, right, and the Rig Veda. We got Vasudeva, the external manifest and the internal manifest, the Vyakta and the Avyakta. And you know, if you're not reading classical Vedic and Tantric texts, the term Vyakta you'll never see it. But if you are reading classical Vedic texts and tantras, like when I say classical, I mean like the older, more original tantras, Avyakta and Vyakta are classical terms regularly used. That which is manifest and that which is not manifest. And we could even look at the Prarabdha karmas versus the karmas that we're experiencing right now within that Avyakta and Vyakta realm. But I think we covered that good. The unmanifest nature possesses two powers. So the Avyakta, the unmanifest, has two Shaktis, and the manifest has three. And is said to possess unlimited power, which is how I translate it, Ananta Shaktiman. Ananta means infinite, unlimited. Shaktiman means one who has Shakti. So that manifest portion, there's just infinite numbers of Shaktis, infinite number of powers, infinite abilities that exist in the manifest realm. Which is pretty cool, you know, when you think about it. There's these two powers on the other realm, but this realm is just filled with, you know, so many different energies and everything is dividing and manifesting. In this verse, there's a hidden concept. And the hidden concept there is that the unmanifest, that's our karana our karana and sukshma sharira. You know, that's the subtle body and the causal body. And then when we have the physical body, there's three shaktis. So that third shakti is that which is making everything manifest. So it's the nila shakti. Nila shakti, which one's that? Were you able to read? Did you get time to read the chapter?
I listened to the lesson. And I got into the second one, but I haven't dove in too deep.
The reading, but as long as you heard it. So the Nila Shakti, and the Nila Shakti, it's called Nila in the Vaishnava Tantra. But the more common term for it is Kali Shakti. It's that dark, or the Tamas Shakti. But we call it Nila Shakti in this tradition. But it's the same, you know? And so that Kali energy, or that Tamas, made the subtle world turn into the physical world. Without the tamas, there'd be no physical reality. So anytime somebody puts down tamas too much, it's like there'd be no reality without tamas. We wouldn't exist. There'd be no physical reality. And so that Kali Shakti generates the physical reality. And Kali is also the personification of time. So there's an element where time was required to create the dense realm. Remember last time we talked about, like, we're in the emergent, like we're coming from an emergent realm of creation. It's not that there was physical matter and then consciousness evolved, right? There was consciousness, and then how did consciousness turn into physical matter?
Yeah, I liked, there was so much out of the chapter that I like, it was like mystical, you know? And yeah. Oh, that was really interesting, especially how Tamas is just fixing things. Tamas, you think of it as
Tamas, yeah.
You know, decaying, but it's really just like transfixing, kind of. It's
totally
solid.
Totally, it's solidifying everything. So there's this really beneficial nature of Tamas, in from a creation of reality perspective. It's not just that negative connotation that we sometimes put on it. In the more Ayurvedic and yogic sphere. In here, we can actually worship the tamas as Kali, as she who's manifesting. So she becomes mother. Kali is mother because she manifested all of this reality. But she's the dark mother, because she's Tamas, manifesting everything. But it's time. So there's this, right here, the difference between the Vyakta and the Avyakta is that there becomes a densification of time. There becomes, things become ordered. And if you think about your dreams, like, you know, in your dream, if you think about Paris, you're in Paris instantly. And even just your imagination, if you think about India, you're mentally in India, but you can't physically be in India. You're limited by space and time. So this physical manifestation isn't, and how can I say it properly? It's not that we're in this reality and space and time are confining us. This reality was created by time, which then created space.
Yeah, you made that distinction. Time
is primary. Time is primary in this, in our tradition, and in the whole, in the foundation of the Jyotish, you know, time is primary. It creates space. Because space, the distance you are from me is based upon how much time it takes for me to get to there.
Yeah.
It's not that the space is making it take that much time. You know, in from an emergent concept of reality, it's the other way around.
Yeah.
So this is an important verse, and it really, there, you know, to get that deeper understanding out of that verse is not. It's you know, you could read that over without thinking twice about it, but it's giving us this deep, yeah.
At one point, you I don't know if it was just a slip in the presentation, but you had said that all three of the gunas are in the unmanifest state, and then once Tamas densifies so much, then yeah, time and everything comes out of it. But like, you know, a lot of other places though, you were saying that it's only sattva and rajas that are unmanifest, and when Tamas comes into the picture, then things are manifest.
And
I mean, and too, when you look at Sankhya, you know, they say like all the gunas are within Prakriti,
yeah,
and then they mix and stuff, you know, gets created. So like, I don't know how we should look at it with this distinction.
And so I leave out the discussion of the eggs, what is the egg? The anda, A-N with a dot, D with a dot, A, anda. And so there's this whole teaching of eggs and the different eggs of creation. So in the first level, the Shuddha Srishti, the pure creation, all the gunas are there, everything is present, and then it goes, and then it creates this egg. And I have this, actually I'll give my interpretation of egg in a little bit, but, and then that egg is cracked open, and then basically the causal world is created. And then there's a certain way that the elements and everything mix. And then that egg becomes the creation of the subtle realm. And then there becomes that final mixing of gunas that then gets cracked for the physical realm to be created. And so these andas, these eggs, on an individual level, I look at them as the different levels of our aura. You know, in the, it's an egg around us. On the cosmic level, it's the morphogenetic field that is the modern term they use, that's holding everything together. And so all the gunas are existing in all of, in from the very beginning, that causal level. But the activity of that one, you know, in the Avyakta, the tamas is not active. It's present because everything is present. It's pradhan. You know what I mean? The building blocks of everything are there, but it's like, it's almost as if it's latent and it's not active. So here when it says the unmanifest nature possesses two powers and possesses, let's see, what's the word that it actually says? Samanvita, you know, it's working with it. It has, there's the, you know, these two, and the third, what's the term? The manifest nature is united with three powers. What's the term I joined? Biryukta. So there's this, you know, the tamas, it then joins these and it creates, it starts doing its job of densification. So both statements that I said are correct, and it's you know, the details are really fine-tuned.
Yeah.
But if you wanted to go deeper in it, you could really just, I mean, you could probably Google, I don't know, like some of the stuff you could never find on Google. But it's changing. Every year there's more and more that goes on there. But there's three levels of creation in Pancharatra. And so within that, it discusses, you know, this level of reality. That makes sense?
Yeah.
All right.
I've got a little reading list now from this chapter, so I'll be digging slowly.
And the tough thing is I had to dig when I did this chapter. I was digging in India. I was going and asking people. I'm like, okay, so there's this term here. Like, what's that mean? Where do I find that? You know, so I had to like follow, and slowly it dug up texts. And it was like, oh, this is where that, you know, it was like, it definitely, no one online was utilizing this teaching. So it was so much groundwork. And it's tough to say, but this chapter probably took as long as the whole rest of the book to write. Just because it required so much research and translating and digging and meeting people to get what these terms meant, because it's not a standard teaching that's you know, regularly out there and given, and in Sanjay's lineage, you know, that diagram that I give with the squares, that they talk about that diagram, mm-hmm. but they use slightly different terminology.
Yeah, I noticed that, and yeah. Didn't seem to quite line it, because I went back to that article and
uh-huh. and so in the article that Guruji wrote, he's giving just his the straight tradition, you know, basically this is what grandfather said, you know, that's the way he writes it. He's not using any text to reference. It's basically what grandfather said. And what text, and one thing that I've learned is, you know, some people they talk trash on that, but he's just writing down what he remembers, and almost everything that he's presented I've eventually found in some text somewhere, and he's always surprised when I find it. He's like, oh, so just like grandfather, you know, and like he then, like, whenever I find like for example in Abhinavagupta, or just as, you know, so he would always teach, you know, with chakra meditation, he would always teach from the heart up. He never taught, you know, the lower three chakras to meditate on. And he had no proof, no reason why you don't meditate on the third chakras. But then I find this meditation by Abhinavagupta that's all about, you know, heart, it's all heart chakra to the chakra just above the head. And it's this full elaboration and again, no reference underneath. And so I'm like, there it is, 8th century text. That's exactly what Sanjay's teaching. You know, he doesn't know why he's teaching it, but, you know, there's something magical about just trusting what grandfather said. For centuries and centuries, just trusting what grandfather said and this knowledge, how it's being passed down. So I'm sure the terminology that Sanjay's using exists in some text somewhere. But here, it's being presented in the text that I was able to find and work with that were teaching this tradition. I'm doing my best to make sure that I'm blending the most common, the terminology in the most common text with the way that Sanjay presents the material. And that aligns with Parashara. Mm-hmm. You know, it's a... Yeah. And they all align conceptually. It's more just terminology wise that they don't, if that makes sense.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But yeah, I mean, without Sanjay's teaching, I would have never been able to crack, you know, to be able to dig to the level that I dug in understanding this stuff without that living tradition of how he teaches the Narayana and the Vasudev. I didn't even notice in this diagram, it's vyakta, avyakta, and time, kala. So we see that line right there is the addition of kala, the addition of time. And that addition of time is kali. It's the nila shakti. It's the tama shakti. It's the dense, that tama shakti is the densification that creates time.
So it's just kind of interesting. You're just reminding me of it as we were talking about this origin of like time. I was watching a documentary a long time ago on ancient like shamanic traditions of mm-hmm. Indus Valley, mm-hmm. and you mentioned Mahakala, mm-hmm. and this documentary was all about like basically they're finding what the oldest deity in the Indus Valley was, and it was Mahakala.
They don't know though. This was just they're guessing.
It's interesting. It seems to be a ancient figure representing time from ancients. Time.
Anything they talk about Mohenjo-daro, always just take with a grain of salt that it's somebody's theory.
Okay.
We don't understand the script yet. All it is pictures, and those pictures are being someone's interpretation of them. So just any of that state, somebody theorizes that, you know, like
yes.
it's not fixed, and it changes every so many years. When they discover new stuff every so many years, they kind of like alter. There's the newest discovery was there's a boat with people rowing, and there's a queen sitting in it, and the general view of Mohenjo-daro is that there were no kings or queens. That it was an egalitarian society because they couldn't find any, you know, king and queen type stuff. And then all of a sudden they dig up and it's the most ancient terracotta image ever. It's like the oldest ever found, Mohenjo-daro. And it's like a queenly figure sitting in there being, fans on two people's side of her and people sitting there rowing. And that just threw all their concepts out the window that they had and all the theories that were built on that. So as they just, that's all.
Yeah, that's just the first time I've even heard reference to Mahakala before.
Great time. And as I said, it's merged with Shiva now. Was it merged with Shiva before? Who knows?
Yes.
But there was definitely a Kalavada school that were just time worshippers alone. All right. Sri Shakti relates to the primal guna of Sattva, Bhu Shakti relates to Rajas guna, and Nila Shakti, who is called the form of the dark goddess, relates to Tamas guna. And I'm using the term relates here, but it's just in these verses I tried to be not to add anything extra as best I could, but at the same time, you have to make it so that your English language is making sense. So I use the word relate. Sri Shakti, Bhu Shakti, Rajaguna. So it doesn't say relate. It's just, there's a correlation between Sri Shakti and Sattva. Just a correlation. And we're left with that, relates to, I think was, an, if I said correlates, that would have also been, I think, adding too much. Relates, I tried to not add too much. But Nila Shakti,
That was one of my main confusions, was the interrelationship between the gunas, the Shakti, and the Vyuhas. I got that the Vyuhas densified into the gunas. That much made sense.
I mean, it's not that they densify into, but yeah, go ahead.
That's how you explained it. So. Yeah, you were diving at one point.
but, you know, we're getting into very subtle concepts. So words are, yeah.
Yeah. And, but you were saying it somewhat corresponds to the Shaktis as well. But then what are they doing, you know, primarily the Gunas? I mean, I get the Shakti-Vyuha kind of relationship with, but where the Gunas play in the middle of all that, it's not totally clear to me as far as
Go ahead.
Oh, go ahead.
No, ask.
No, it's okay. You can
finish.
Well, no, if they're more active, if they're, I don't know if you want to say a grosser form, and that's what we call them when they start, you know, manifesting everything on lower levels, and uh-huh. at higher levels, the Shri and the Vyuhas that are more subtle, if you will. Mm-hmm. That's
The Vyuhas,
the only thing I could kind of,
well, the Vyuhas are the most subtle.
Yeah,
and they're states of consciousness, and you know, as we talked before, you know, if we say consciousness, are we talking about manifestation? You know, it's like, it's not the best word because it doesn't. We are in the most unmanifest realm of witness awareness, and it's the quality of the witness that we are looking at with the Vyuhas.
I kind of associated them with, like, in Sankhya, you know, you have this idea of that Purusha is kind of, you know, this thing that's observing or, you know, not part of the material. And so it just seemed like the Vyuhas were kind of that same state, but a little more specified.
Fully.
With how, exactly. You know, how the Purusha is functioning.
Exactly.
So So
this is where it gets dangerous because, when you say how the Purusha is functioning, then the Purusha is moving and there's a function, and so then it becomes Shakti.
It's not doing it. I get that. It's not doing it. Yeah. It just, I mean, how it is in relationship to the other things that are doing things, I guess, would be more specific.
However we want to word it, but yes. The Vyuhas are states of the Purush. They're states of the witness.
Yeah.
And then as soon as they have a function, then that becomes the Shakti. So, you know, what is the function of the Shashupti, the deep sleep state? And I've been, and in here I called it deep sleep because that's what everybody calls it. But I've been, in my most recent translations, letting go of the term deep sleep and using latent, LATENT, latent consciousness, instead of deep sleep consciousness. And if you want to go into that, I'll go into it. But, there, you know, I think it's definitely more, it points more to the nature of that state of consciousness than, because the scriptures, they say, this is the state of consciousness that you experience when you're sleeping and there's no dream. They don't say that that is the state. They're like, that's when you experience it. And just to change, to make it a different direction, swapna is the dream state that you experience when you're sleeping and you're dreaming. But if we shut our eyes right now and we're in a, you know, either completely went pratyahara or we're in a flotation tank where we weren't aware of anything else and we just focused on our imagination, that's the swapna realm. That's the realm, it's the dream realm. Or I've been using the term the imaginal realm. It's the realm of images in the consciousness. So in that same way that, you know, yes, swapna is dream, but it's the imaginal realm. And in the same way, the Shashupti is the latent realm. It's the realm where everything is in its seed form, where everything is in its essential nature with all other attributes, you know, withdrawn into it or not yet exploded from it. But as soon as those states start acting, then we have the Shakti. So the function is the Shakti. Without it acting, it's the state. As soon as it has action, it's the Shakti. And the comparison goes, there's fire and then there's heat. You know, so you have the fire and the heat, and can you really separate them? But you can differentiate them. I see the light or I see the heat. You know what I mean? They're these different attributes, but you can't actually separate them. So in the same way, that concept goes to these states of the Purusha and their Shakti. We are using terminology to differentiate them and talk about different elements, but on a certain, on a real level, we can't separate heat from fire. But we can talk about the heat that fire gives us versus the light that fire gives us. So that makes sense.
But then where does the gunas play into this though?
And so here, you know, if we look straight at this verse, it's giving us whether we say they correlate. Whether we say that the Shaktis create it, whether we say that the Gunas created the Shaktis or the Shaktis created the Guna, from classical Tantra, we would say the Shaktis created the Guna. Just because the Purush and the Shakti are primary. But then, in a similar way, can we differentiate the nature of Sri Shakti and Sattva Guna? Not really. Because that function that Sri Shakti has is Sattva Guna.
Yeah. So it's almost like, I mean, a synonym in a way, or just another... There's a distinction there.
There's a distinction, you know, but again, that distinction is like heat and fire. When we say heat, we mean something different than fire, but we can't separate the heat from the fire.
Mm-hmm.
So the nomenclature is only in for our purposes to be able to reference and distinguish and to discuss. In its essential nature, it's undifferentiated. We're unable to differentiate. Both that Shakti from the Guna and the Guna from the Avasta. But they, one is the function of. Just like heat, is heat a function of fire? It's the nature of fire. And if we take it to the level of the Lakshmi Tantra discusses, it calls Vishnu is that supreme being. And then Lakshmi, his consort, is aham tva. So he's I. He's beingness. He's that which is, that existence, I. And she is I-ness. Aham tva, tva N-E-S. So aham is I. She's I-ness. She's the nature of I. She's that... Like, what is I like? Well, all of a sudden it's you know, well, I is existing, it's being, it's... again, it's become so hard to separate, but there is that, the difference between I and I-ness. And it comes right back down to that Purusha Prakriti realm. Differentiation. But if we wanted to be theological or tantralogical or... The Shakti is primary. And if we wanted to, and you know, I mention in here, it's like, on one level, this is a creation that is, you know, first this happened, then that happened. You know, if we wanted to look at it from physical level, looking up at it, it's, you know, in that way. So the Shaktis would have been created first, and they created the Guna. But really, if we're looking at it from more the within the system, we're not going to differentiate.
Okay.
But we're going to look more at the correlations.
But I mean, you know, like if I'm referencing like, okay, we want to create sattva in our life, usually we don't say, you know, I want to create, put some strength. I mean, different, depending on what you're practicing and stuff, but usually it's not like, you know, we don't talk about... getting more Sri Shakti.
Oh, fully. You can now.
Yeah.
You can fully say that, yes. You could, instead of saying
but we could use those two terms kind of interchangeably in a way, but with
But okay. you still could say, and if you were a Shakta tantric, you could easily say, you know, if the person needed more sattva, you could say they need more Sri Shakti in their life. You can totally do that. And when we get to remedies, we're looking at the remedies, and we really literally are basing our remedies off of, do they need more Sri Shakti? Do they need more Bhu Shakti? Mm-hmm. Do they need more Nila Shakti? And you know, and I think I mentioned it just slightly somewhere, but the whole Mahavidya realm is completely based around the Nila Shakti. And the Nila Shakti and the Mahavidyas, they're when a planet's Nietzsche. And the Sri Shakti is when the planet's Ucha. So an Ucha planet is in its sattvic form, it's filled with the Sri Shakti. The Nietzsche planet, it's in its fallen form, it's filled with the Nila Shakti. So yes, you can speak it like that.
Okay, that's clear then, yeah.
Okay, yeah.
So, I feel like I understand Rajas and Tamas much more over time in this class. Yeah. And I thought I understood Sattva more, but I'm finding now, you know, it's changing.
Well, it's relative. The gunas are relative.
Yes.
And whenever, a lot of times when they teach them as like these things, but... You know, it's all relative.
Yes.
If we're in Mississippi and we're like in a community that's about to celebrate tomorrow or the next day, I mean, there's people getting... Have you seen some of the celebrations they're about to have?
About what? Oh, yeah.
Trump's inauguration? I mean, you know, if we went into that community and we started like differentiating Rajas, Tamas, and Sattva, we can't just say, oh, it's all Tamas or it's all Rajas.
Yes.
We need to differentiate. It's the context. And so within that, we're what is sattva in that realm? There's sattva there, you know, relative. It's all relative.
So tamas has this obviously inherent like physical quality. I feel like sattva and it's densifying to matter. And so sattva, can I like say it has like an opposite kind of effect in that it's like, it's not densifying matter. It's like transcendent in a way.
It's transcending matter, if you could say that.
Okay.
It has a more ethereal nature to it.
Yes.
And we have to be careful, what do we mean by densification? And remember, right now, see, what you learned before of the gunas was from a materialistic perspective, meaning that there's this material world and then there's consciousness in it. Now, if we jump to the other side of the emergent reality and say this is consciousness manifesting, then from that side, tamas is that which is restricting consciousness and limiting it and putting it into smaller, you know, and making it so that it focuses more and more on its own reality. Where sattva is that which is opening it up so that it can have more of a view of this emergent reality. But also at the same time, you know, I just want to, you know, the Gita is very clear. Don't be attached to the sattva either.
Yeah.
Because even that's a guna. You know, and our goal is not to be attached to the gunas. Our goal is to be attached to that which is the witness of the gunas.
Yeah.
And the sattva is what allows us to have that greater witness ability, but it's not the witness, the sattva. Uh-huh. It's just a method to get there. On the pure path.
Yes.
Did I answer?
Yeah. Okay. Every time I'm digesting all this stuff, I'm, you know, it's kind of hard to directly explain what I'm learning. You know, it's subtle, but it's cool. I like it a lot.
And just referring to that, you know, it's like Parashara calls the Nila Shakti the Dwanta form, the dark form. And so it's this form that veils consciousness. Because that tamas, that makes it so that we don't remember our original nature. When the kid's born, why do they forget their past life? It's the dwanta, the veiling happens.
Yes.
So the tamas makes us forget. So the tamas is keeping this play, the lila. Remember he mentioned, he called it a lila before.
Yeah, I wrote this down.
It's keeping the lila so that it's a lila. It's like if you were went to go see a theater and watched a play, if you just sat there the whole time remembering that you're in a theater and that these are teenagers performing or whatever it is, you wouldn't enjoy it very much. But if you just let go and you kind of get into the play, and at one point when the heroine gets you, you let your feelings get hurt too, and you've lost yourself in there.
Yeah.
And they correlate. It's a classical example that they use in the text of how we get veiled. We forget. We enter this play and fully forget that we're even there. We've become so part of the story. They're even acting on a stage, but we still like fall into believing it. Or when we're watching it on TV or something, we fall into believing it, you know?
I really like how you referenced Buddhism and the difference between the, you know, having a worldview of a, you know, the universal nature being a play or whether it being suffering.
Uh-huh.
And that's great because, like, you know, there's so much deep philosophy in Buddhism, but it always seems like such a just that inherent concept from the beginning of that life is suffering just kind of put a bad taste in my mouth about it. So
and it all depends on your moon.
Yeah.
If you had Saturn aspecting your moon, you'd be like, that's right. This world is suffering. That's the truth. You see, truth is so flavored by our own views of the planets. So what is truth? There is, you know, it's... So this last paragraph here, Frank, I talk about the Rahasya Traya of the Saptasati. Have you done that research yet?
No, I've got some copies of it. I haven't dug into it though.
So to fully understand the Rahasya Traya, at the end you have to understand the Andas and the concept of the creation through the different Anda. And basically what they do in the Rahasya Traya is they discuss, they basically personify all the elements of the Anda creation, the eggs, as goddesses, as Shakti, and they turn it into a play. And there's this, and so Rahasya Traya means the secret of the three. And you know, there's three main chapters in the Durga Saptasati. So if those three levels of creation that they discuss there in their personified form is the secret, then when we go back to the Durga Saptasati, the three different chapters are each talking about one of the levels of creation. So that we're looking at the causal body, the subtle body, and the physical body, and that creation, what causes a problem in it, how we fix that. You know, there's a whole teaching of the three levels, of the three bodies, the three realms that is encoded in the Saptasati.
Worthwhile.
At one point I said, oh, I'll write on this. And then I was like, what purpose to write on it? You know, but let's see. When the,
just kind of random, but Rahasya?
Is that secret? Secret.
Does that have to do with Rahu at all? Is there a similar root there?
It's
different?
Let's see. The root of Rahasya is... secret, private, concealed, mysterious. Does it give us the root? It doesn't give us the root. I never like when they don't give the root. So it comes from Rahas. And Rahas is meaning solitude, privacy, secret, retirement, secret mystery. And Rahasya is that which is of that. If we look at Rahu, see Rahu, if you notice, has a long A. You know, so it's a completely different... And so there's the general is that Rahu is coming from Rabba, which is similar to graha, and as a root. And so it's coming from he's a grasper, he's grabbing. Versus the shor a, which is meaning a secret.
Got it.
Or private. Yeah, you got to use the bathroom. You said
yes.
I'll push pause.
Show kind of background or orientation or teachers are, because I mean you give a little on your bio stuff, but I mean you were
a little, talking about a little, yeah.
Another side here. I don't know. If, yeah.
So, I mean, and so there's what I've studied, there's what I am, there's what I'm initiated into, and you know, do we differentiate what we're initiated into from what we're in, you know, into and what we study? It becomes, you know. But yeah, you know, whatever we are and are practicing always biases us on a certain level. But I like to believe that the tradition that I'm in is such an unbiased tradition that it's. But I was completely in a more Shaiva path before meeting Sanjay, and you know, doing mostly Shaiva sadhana and studying Shaiva texts. And I was even at one point planning to maybe go to Hawaii and become a monk at the Kauai ashram. And the universe had other plans, though. And
were you with the Hinduism Today people?
Yeah, I was literally planning to maybe,
Okay.
Yeah, and but you know them, and I was at that time, you know, going to India, studying with different people, meeting different people, but then when I met Sanjay, you know, the kickdown was just so full on, and he doesn't kick down like he used to. Like, I mean, what he gives these days is peanuts compared to what it used to be, And part of why it's become peanuts to what he used to give is at that time, he had no clue what the rest of the world knew. You know, he's coming from this deep tradition in Puri that's like really clustered. And he, you know, when he'd go out to debate, he'd go to these debates where there's these big pandas that are like, you know, have memorized all the Vedas and 400 tantras, and you know, and so these guys are debating, and so Sanjay just assumes that like that's normal everywhere. And so, you know, he's teaching, and he's, you know, on a certain level he's just like, yeah, like, you know, and he's just giving it out, and for a certain level, and I learned this concept 2 years ago, that we have different levels of maturity, and when you're at a certain level of maturity, the next level above you looks like you can respect that. But if you go 3 or 4 levels above you, they look crazy. Like what they're talking about is absurd, you know? And so people just, they're like, what is this guy talking about? When Sanjay started lecturing and teaching, they're like, he's making stuff up. He's, you know, like people were accusing him. And it was quite a, you know, he was quite hurt by like what people were saying. And to him, he's just talking about what they all talk about in the village and Bhubaneswar, like with the pundits gathering and, you know, and, but once he finally started to get like, oh my gosh, these people don't even know this and that and this and that, then he kind of started like sharing less and kind of not giving as much. And it's sad. It's sad. But I'm glad I got to study with him before that happened. And but yeah, the kickdown was just so full and filled. And then I went and I got to live in Orissa with him for a while. And so, I mean, like, you know, his mother made food, ate at the same table. And, you know, like, I would go with his mom. His mother would go and always, every week, go visit different holy people and get teachings. So we would go, and I, you know, I just started to learn the whole Odia Vaishnavism. And the Orissa, or Odia Vaishnavism, is primarily You know, some people call it Tantric Vaishnavism, some people call it Utkalia Vaishnavism, some people call it Pancharatra Vaishnavism. For them, it's just their Vaishnavism and everybody else has got their thing. You know, they don't give it a more specific name. But the texts, if you look at their texts, they would be classified as Vaishnava Sahajas or Sahajayanas. And the Sahajas, if we look at the Hare Krishna material, the Gaudiya Vaishnava, every other line they're cursing the Sahajas. Oh, those Sahajas, just be careful you don't fall in line with those Sahajas. So they don't talk too much. They practice, and a lot of their practices are secret. But in that practice of the Vaishnava Sahajas, Sahajayana, it's a very big view. And, you know, one of the main teachings that, you know, once I got the teaching that Achyutananda gave, which is the main Vaishnava lineage that Sanjay's family is within, I kind of couldn't go anywhere else, you know. And he straight said that God is completely formless and beyond anything you can imagine. Any form you use has nothing to do with God. It's completely you. And it's for you, it's for your limited mind to be able to grasp this divinity. And that's like premise. And so then we start talking about deities. And Shiva's like this, and this is... It's like, and we get, okay, it's not that Shiva's this, but this is what we need. This is what our mind needs to grasp this frequency that we know as Shiva. We look at Kali, and so it was like, I can look at gods and goddesses that way. It's a whole different, you know, concept than we get in a lot of other places. And in that realm, everything opens up. Any form that anybody worships anywhere, you can like look at its frequency and what it's doing and what is it. It's, you know, the deities are functions of divinity. And so who's, you know, if we look at Jesus is a savior. He's saving people. And you have faith and get saved. So he's a form of Vishnu, clearly. Because, you know, Shiva doesn't care whether you have faith or not. Shiva is he's not an orthodox, he's an orthoprax. What Shiva's about what you do, not what you believe, because it's a different level of frequency. So, you know, to me, the Vaishnava Sahajayana or the Utkal Vaishnavism, whatever it's one chooses to call it, allowed me what I believe to get to an archetypal level where all religions work, and any of them work.
Is Achyutananda, is he considered kind of the spiritual head or the person who brought that down? Because I was associated more with the Jyotish side of things first, and it sounded like his associations with Chaitanya were, they were mixed, it sounded, but
what do you mean
always
mixed?
Seemed more like, well, some of like the background you give where, people came to Orissa and, the whole conflict between Bhakti, those whole arguments between Bhakti-only versus this more expansive view and that kind of thing. But, within Sanjay's lineage, it's a spiritual lineage as well as the Jyotish side of it together in a way.
It is, but he does his best to avoid the spiritual side. He does his best to avoid taking on any spiritual, and yet he's filling with mantras and how we get moksha and the way to live and the practices to do. So it's completely spiritual, but he does his best to say, you go get your big guru. Don't take me as your guru.
No, he's not.
But in the Utkal Vaishnava system, it is not a sannyasa system. It is a householder lineage system. And people can be sannyas, but it's not required.
There is one other
saying is, it's the sannyasa is not required in the Utkal Vaishnavism, and it's mm-hmm. not a sannyas based system, and that's where the Brahmanism can sometimes, you know, get mixed in and be confusing. But it's the majority of teachers in the Utkal Vaishnava system are householders, no different than Sanjay.
Yeah.
And so he holds back and he does his best to not be spiritual teacher, but he is. And the other main lineage holders all are people just like him.
Mm.
Who've done certain sadhanas, have certain powers, give certain dikshas, and, you know. Yeah. But I'm mm-hmm. initiated into what, you know, into this lineage of Vaishnavism.
Yeah.
And we're going really off course from the chapter here. But I was like, you know, my request to, because I explained how Achyutananda talks through the plates, correct?
Yeah. I might try to visit there at the end of the year, so.
Good.
Curious, but.
And spend some time. Don't just do a 1-2 day. Like, do a little bit longer of a stay.
Could you explain the plates? What are they?
So these plates, they're metal and they're empty. You ask a question, touch them, and they say what your question is, even just what you're thinking your question is, and they say the answer on. But it's a prashna. And the more serious your question, the more serious the answer. And before I met my Diksha Guru into the Utkal Vaishnavism, I went to the plates and I'm like, you know, actually I'm not going to tell this story. We'll just leave it at that. Any which way. Achyutananda guided me to a very particular teacher to get my initiation from.
Yeah, you reference the story in one of it. That's why okay. I'm bringing it up, because it was always a question in the back of my head. So
yeah. But you know, I also work with Mark Dyskowski, who's a big teacher of Kashmiri Shaivism, and you know, work with a few other Shakta scholars in Varanasi, and so I like to be well rounded. And as I say with the Jyotish, as long as you don't mix up the concepts, there's nothing wrong with learning more. You know, study with whatever teacher. Just make sure you get, that's this tradition, this is that tradition. You know? If I started saying Kriya Shakti, Nietzsche, you know, Kriya Jnana, and Nila, it's Icha. Icha Shakti. I started using those terms in this philosophy, then I'd be mixing two realms that aren't mixed. You know, like they're separate realms, because we could correlate Kriya Shakti and Icha Shakti and Jnana Shakti, but they're slightly different, because as soon as they have a different name, they're some of the functions are the same and some functions are different. So we got to be careful when we, you know, we keep them in different compartments. That way, when everything is relative to whatever, we're on the same page, and things are what we stated. All right. We ready to move to the next verse?
Yeah, we can. Yeah. Thank you for the tangent.
When the fourth quarter, called Vasudeva, becomes directed by Sri Shakti, it takes the form of Shankarsana, Pradyumna, and Aniruddha. So on part, when the fourth quarter, called Vasudeva, becomes directed, and what's the term I'm translating as directed? Parita. So it becomes impelled, incited, directed by. You know, it's getting motivated. It's beginning to move. And so the Sri Shakti is aham twa. You know, there's aham and aham twa. There's God, and then there's the nature of God. There's the supreme I, and then the nature of the supreme I. And so there's, you know, Purush, and then there's that, or Vasudev, and then there's the Sri Shakti. So that Sri Shakti is that function of the Supreme. And so when the Supreme starts functioning, the functioning starts turning, and the multiplication of the different states of consciousness arise. And this one took forever to dig and to find the right people that understood it and explained it to me and everything. But the fourth, it takes the form of Shankarsana, Pradyumna, and Aniruddha. And Shankarsana, Pradyumna, and Aniruddha are the personification of Shashupti, Swapna, and Jagrat. Straight. Okay? Just they're the personifications of them. And then it says, the all-pervasive Lord accompanied by Tamashakti called Shankarsana. Pradyumna is accompanied by Raja Shakti, and Aniruddha is accompanied by Sattva Shakti. So, the thing is, the Sri Shakti is creating the Shankarsana. The Bhu Shakti is creating the Pradyumna, and the Tamashakti is creating the Aniruddha. But there's a switch that happens. And so that switch is what is the mixing of gunas that creates reality. And this same concept you'll see exists in the Saptasati, in the Rahasyatraya. They describe this switching. And in all the undas, they talk about, you know, in the unda creations, they talk about that. What do we want to talk about with that? Let's go to the next verse. Unless you have a question relative to that verse. Shaktis and gunas and gods and states of consciousness.
Yeah, I think I'm good.
Shankarsana propelled the birth of the individual soul. Pradyumna is the cause of the present mind. Aniruddha is the supporting manifestation of Ahankara, the creator. Each has all the powers of accomplishing Shakti, but acts according to the predominant Shakti. So it's saying each has all, you know, they're coming from the Pradhana. So this is a deeper level where each has all the elements, and it kind of answers partly a certain question that you were asking before with there's two Shaktis, but then it becomes three with the physical thing. So here, you know, each of these has all of the Shaktis, but there becomes a predominant Shakti that gives it its nature, that gives it its function. And so, individual soul. Here the term is Mahan. It's an old, you know, it took me for a while because... And this one, a few of these verses I translate very different than some of the translations out there. I don't know if you've compared. But, and this one I translate very different. And that's because Mahan, you know, in researching the Pancharatra texts, Mahan is an old term for Atma. And it's one that went out of style. Pretty, you know, like it's a classical term for Atma. It's not a modern term, which gives us a certain, you know, if we wanted to try and date this and where this was coming from, this is telling us that this, whether this was an insertion or whoever made this, it's a more classical terminology that's being utilized. So Shankarsana is creating this Mahan, this individual. This individual soul, and the Pradyumna is creating. Let's see the term used here. Pradyumna, Shankarsana, Jata, Pradyumnad, Swayam, Jata, Shankarsana, Jata, Pradyumnad, Yad. And then we have Ahamkriti. And so Ahamkriti is, and here, it's this goes to the fact that we're a theistic Sankhya, not a a non-theistic Sankhya, because here that Ahankara is seen as Brahma. It's called the creator. And if we, you know, if you look at the classical Sankhya delineation, it's from the Ahankara, we have Rajas and Tamas and Sattva, and we have the Indriyas and the Tattvas, the Mahabhutas, that are originating, all coming from Ahankara. So in that sense, Ahankara is creator. So it's Brahma, because it's creating the universe, the Ahankara. That the I maker. And again, you know, there's like, and I'm tonight we don't have time, but there's huge philosophy that's hidden like an acorn in that verse. Aniruddha is the supporting is the vyuha, you know, the state of consciousness of Ahankara, the creator. So each has the power of accomplishing, but acts according to the predominant Shakti. So each is acting according to its predominance. And in the recording, I talk about, you know, the Sattva and the Shushupti, the latent consciousness and the Tamas merging, creating the Jiva, the Rajas being the mind, and then the Tamas consciousness and the Sattva creating the Ahankara. So I'm not going to go...
My only big confusion with some of this level is, too, is the... Where's the Bodhi? Because at a certain point you said Jiva is associated with Bodhi, but then in here, I think you've got a chart later on in 24, Bodhi is a function with Manas and Pradyumna. And so
this is the big thing. It becomes
fitness system per se, but
so depending on the text, how to explain this in a simple term without going off on a big so different texts, the terms mean different things in different texts, and in some texts Bodhi was the term they used for mind. They didn't mean intellect, they meant mind by the term Bodhi. And they didn't use manas. And to them, manas in some texts meant the whole system of thought consciousness. And Bodhi meant the mind, as we mean, when we say mind, they were saying Bodhi. Like for example, Lakshmi Tantra uses Bodhi in this way. And there's a handful of other tantras and Upanishadic texts where Bodhi is referring to mind in general. So when we take our concept of the five parts of mind, and there being Ahankara, Bodhi, Manas, you know, like this, that's a different system. Than what they're referring to in most of these. In most of these, they're not referring to that system of five aspects of mind. And so Bodhi in most of these is referring to manas and Bodhi. They're all referring to that imaginal realm of mind, of consciousness. And we got to be real careful that we don't trip on words, you know, when we're trying to get this. especially being that the different, and even this Mahan, they're meaning Jiva. They're not meaning a cosmic principle. In that same way. And who knows what they actually mean in the Sankhya Karika if we take that backwards, you know, and from another perspective. But the Bodhi and the Manas are considered, they're interchangeable in this model.
Okay.
And so from the Jagrat, we have Ahankara. From the Swapna realm, we're having Manas, Bodhi, you know, interchangeable. And you could say Bodhi is an aspect of Manas, or Manas is an aspect of, however you want to say it. They're existing on that realm. Yeah. We can use them interchangeably. And then on the Shushupti level, we're looking at the Jiva. Did that clarify?
Yeah, that's perfect.
All right.
Yeah.
And here I just wrote mana, so I probably should have wrote mana / Bodhi, but you know, it's like...
You do it another chart, so I was making sure.
Yeah, it's, and And let's see, so with the time ticking, we are almost to 8. So we have Shankarsana, we have Pradyumna. I think you guys get those concepts, right? Do we need to go into that?
Yeah, I'm going to go over everything a little more because I went a little forward this week, so I'm going to review a little and
Review that. From a Jyotish perspective, they matter less. Shankarsana, Pradyumna, Aniruddha, they're more for spiritual practice level of understanding, but it's the Shaktis that we really are primarily using when we talk about remedies and things of that nature. And you know, Shankarsana, Pradyumna, and Aniruddha, they are when we personify them, but what's most important is that you understand Jagrat, Shashupti, Swapna, and Shashupti. You know, those states of consciousness, which correlate to the waking consciousness, the physical body, the dream, the aura, the subtle body, the imagination, the mind, and the causal body, the jiva, the latent consciousness. As long as we get those things are correlated. That's the most important thing to understand from here. And we also have the levels of speech that go with that. Let's see, do I go into that? And at the bottom of 16, let's see. At the bottom of page 16, as when a sperm meets an egg, a new creation begins, so does the seed of... I was like, oh, did I talk about the eggs here? I didn't. But there's... Like, I mean, there's a huge philosophy about the andas of creation and these different spheres.
Can you define that word? Anda?
Yeah. A, N with a dot, N with a dot, A. It means egg.
Okay, yes.
But it could also mean sphere. You know, in the sense of, you know, our aura is this sphere around us. It's this egg around us. And at the same time, the whole physical creation of the universe is this big egg.
Series of eggs.
And the whole, and that whole physical creation has an arc egg around it as well, just like we do. And it also then has a morphogenetic field around it, you know, just like we have our causal field. So it's on both levels. And when they talk about creation, as one is created, so is the other created. As we are created, so is the universe created, and vice versa. Om and the three levels of speech. Do we need to go into that? Let's see. The Maitri Upanishad says, there are two forms of Brahman, the shaped and the unshaped. What is shaped is the unreal. What is unshaped is the real. So it's talking about this manifestation is not real, and that which is beyond this manifestation is the real. It is Brahman. It is light. What is light is the sun. This is Om. It becomes the self. It is divided itself into three. Om is three elements. Through them, all this is woven on it as a warp and weft. So, samaya is a word that's used. And it's talking about the weaving. So, when we look at these three levels of creation, it becomes this whole, it's almost like how these different tattvas, these elementals are woven. And we're physical, we're subtle, and we're causal, but they're all woven together. It's not, you know, like if I want to take this string right here, I can't just pull that string. It's woven in, it's part of the shirt now. And so in the same way, those three bodies are woven together. They're not, I can talk about a string there, I can talk about this string being a different color than that string, but it's come together to create that shirt. In the same way, those three bodies have come together to create you as who you are. You are the weaving of those three bodies. You're not one of those bodies or the other one. When we look at somebody and we look at their chart, we're looking at the weaving of those three bodies. And so when one of those bodies gets out of, you know, has a disharmony, it shows up on all the bodies. So when there's a karma on the causal level that's out of balance, it shows up as a thought process in the mind. It shows up as something in the body, something being experienced in reality. So, you know, these people that believe that there's a gravitational effect that's making the planets work, what are they doing? There's no gravitational effect that's doing that. It's working on this causal level and interacting through this weave. Let's see. 6 states. Let's see. Brahma, Rudra, Rudra. Terminology changes. Scriptures. And sonic theory. So in the ancient world, scripture was considered to create reality. And I had to put that in there. After doing all the Pancharatra research, I had to state that. Because, I mean, all the texts, it's the foundation of every single one of those texts. The scripture creates reality. And what does that mean? And really, it was Mark Dyskowski that made me understand what that meant. And basically, you know, the way, and he explained it, you know, it was about an hour talk for him explaining it. And so I'm not going to do the hour talk, but I'm going to do the summation of that. But basically, it's like, if you went and read a book on physical matter, that you breathe because you have lungs, and there's electrical stimulus and hormones that are making you breathe, then you look at yourself as a machine. And reality, everything is a bunch of machines walking around. So you read this text that talked about like us being material machines, and then you perceive everything, that you look at the world like it's a material, everything's material machines. That's how you see reality. Right now, we just read this whole concept of emergent reality. So we're totally looking, everything is all of a sudden much more subtle than it was before. You know what I mean? Like, from that dense perspective, we're looking at everything as states of consciousness and gunas that are holding it together, and it being a frequency that's vibrating, and as your frequency changes, other things are manifesting. So, I mean, how that's making us look at life is very different than the guy who's looking at life as everything is machines.
Indeed.
So, in the ancient world, the scripture was considered to create reality. Your whole concept of reality, what the realm that you lived in, was based upon the knowledge that you received. So when they took these Pancharatra texts and all these concepts, and they honored them, they're like, wow, I'm gonna like live in this like really expansive reality because of the information here. So that scripture is creating reality from that concept. As reality is perceived through concepts and language, the scripture gives particular conceptions and language in which you alter your individual understanding of reality. Thinking requires language. Bhartahari used the terms consciousness and word interchangeably. And this is something I've been stewing on so much, like as part of, you know, my next book, like I really want to go deep into this concept. And I haven't figured out a way to really put it into words good. But if I ask you, I say, what is consciousness? What is it?
Perception.
But perception? I mean, if you go into pratyahara and you're not perceiving anything, the consciousness is still there, isn't it?
Well, I knew that that wasn't going to be adequate.
You know? But so... There's this root concept from the Vedic doctrine that was taken into the Tantric doctrine, and that was that the word, the thinking, and when they say when you're thinking in images and words and concepts, and so that is consciousness. Consciousness is communicated through word. It's communicated through a languaging. And that languaging, you know, a dog is communicating through a languaging. And there's body language as well, and that fits into what they mean by word and languaging. But that communication is consciousness. Each level of consciousness has a sound or word associated with it. And so talking about the different levels of speech there, and I'm not going to go too into that now, but it's absolutely key. Let's see. All right. So I'll let you guys read this and listen to the online thing. Let's just talk about this little diagram right here. And wow, it's printing kind of a little messed up. It's supposed to be down a little bit. This state experience of deep meditation. So if we look from Srishti, from the creation, if we look at the Vasudev level, you know, if we're looking at consciousness coming into manifestation, the consciousness, if we look at that top graph, it's small, you know, the material reality. And as it goes more into the Shushupti, as it goes into the Swapna, as it goes into Jagrat, physical densification is getting bigger. But consciousness, if we look at the bottom one, is slowly getting more and more less and less. It's more and more dense. And you know, I talked a little bit about Ken Wilber and how he kind of took the theory, but he was taking it from a non-emergent perspective. And from that non-emergent perspective, you really can't integrate this concept right here in. That the more manifest we become, the less conscious we become. That the more subtle something is, the more expansive the consciousness is. Which also means that the less rational, because in this less, the Jagrat realm, that's rational consciousness. That's scientific rationality. You see how big it is in the material, but look how much consciousness is in it. It's so small. And then we go into that Swapna realm, which is the dream and the shamanic realm, and consciousness increased, but material reality decreased. So materialism, they kind of laugh at that, you know, on a certain level, because its material validity has decreased, but yet its conscious power has increased. When we get to the causal level, which is what we work on as astrologers, that material realm has decreased, but yet the consciousness has increased. And so when we look at Venus, you know, it's less. We're using 9 archetypes, but those 9 archetypes hold this huge amount of information. Where now if I instead of said Venus, I said, let me use female instead, the archetype of woman. All of a sudden, I just limited myself. I brought myself more into density, more into material realm, and I just limit it to how expansive I can take that archetype. Where by taking it into the planetary realm as Venus, I can go into water elements, I can go into animal realms, I can go into states of consciousness, I can go into creative realms, I can go into business, I can go into, you know what I mean? I can start manifesting on so many levels. And that's because the consciousness is so much bigger by having less. By having less form, less rational reality, I've just gained in conscious power. And so when we're using these planets as archetypes and reading the chart, less becomes more. We have and that's the big thing, you know, and I always bring it up because it's the worst review I have on Amazon. Somebody wrote on about my sign chapter. They're like, you're not teaching anything, you know, but I'm teaching elements, I'm teaching gunas, I'm teaching the relationship between elements and gunas and how they're and male and female. And so it's such rudimentary elementals. But yet from that, you know, we're in the Shushupti realm in that because we're in the most minimal. And from that most minimal, we can expand 100 million-fold more than somebody who elaborated more on what Aries is. Somebody who gave this bigger explanation of Aries, they've actually lost information. They haven't gained information. They've lost consciousness, but they've made it more manifest.
Yes.
So it's an interesting realm to understand here, but it's one that we have to understand, and you need to be understanding emergent reality, because this is not material. If we are coming as materialists, what I just said is crazy. It's absolutely absurd. I'm a lunatic. But from an emergent reality, of course, makes perfect sense.
Well, yeah. I mean,
it is interesting though. Like when you get into the quantum physics stuff, I mean, they're going so deep into the material that they're coming out the other end. You know,
on a certain level, they're starting to enter that causal realm, and then the rules of the causal realm start working. So they get to that realm, and then they're all of a sudden, they're coming up with these rules that when they bring back, make no sense on a physical level. And to me, the issue is, with quantum science, quantum physics, and standard physics, that they're having a hard time is, from the materialist perspective, they want to have a rule that works the same everywhere. And if they get that there's three realms of existence, and at this realm, this is the rules that work. But when we go down to the subtle realm, these are the rules that work. And then when we go down to the causal realm, these are the rules that matter works on. They can't grasp that. It's not, you know, they can't hold that. But as soon as we get some scientist who's like, you know, organizing everything according to that, it'll all quantum physics and all the rules will completely be able to be right next to the physical rules and not contradict them.
If quantum's working the causal and, you know, Newtonian's working physical, what could we say anything's working at the subtle on that level as far as, is that more?
I think there is a certain level, you know, of what Einstein's reality? That physics is called, relativity and but there's quantum physics in between physics, Newtonian physics and quantum physics. There's Einstein's version of physics, and that is I can't remember the term, but that's what I would say. You know, they're looking at energy and mass and that equality and their transfer, and so there is this transition realm before you get into the quantum.
Okay.
In my opinion, and that's just opinion.
Yep. Yeah.
All right, and then we get into the Sankhya here. And I think we'll save that for next week. The straight up Sankhya. And Frank, maybe you can, I don't know if you want to break it down or, I mean, now we just get into standard Sankhya over here. Except in the standard Sankhya. We're standard Bhagavata Sankhya.
The greetings are new, so yeah, there's a little.
Before next week, Frank, dig into, look at Charaka Samhita.
Yeah, I've been meaning to go back to, because I've read that before, like some years ago, and I was like, this is a little different, but it's...
You just let it go, you know, because you let it go because nobody was teaching it.
Yeah, exactly. So I'm sure it'll make plenty of sense now.
So go back, look at, and this is Frank homework, you don't have to do this. You just read what I wrote and listen to the lecture. Yeah. Frank, I'm going to give... Frank's working at a different level over there. Look at both the Sankhya given by Charaka and Shashruta. And then Abhinava Gupta has a commentary on... what verse is it? Let me see real fast. I'll dig it up for you. Save you some time. Gita. Give me just a second and I will.
Frank's in the AP class.
I just want you to look at a particular commentary written by Abhinava Gupta on the Gita in relative to what we're talking about here? Time finding it. The place I recommend getting where you can find that commentary is there's a site called Gita Super Site, GITASUPERSITE .IITK.AC.IN.
Oh, is that where they have all the different translations compared and all that?
Yeah, and there you'll find Abhinava Gupta's translation of that verse. It's just an easy place. And I want to say it's around verse 11 of, let me guess, let's see how good my memory is. I'd say 3:11. Could be 4:11. It's somewhere.
You can check both.
Oh, let's see. Yeah, nope, 3:11, I was right. Yep, that's pretty good. Sometimes I impress myself. Chapter 3, verse 11 of Abhinava Gupta's commentary on the Gita. And just look at the Charaka Shashrut Sankhya, look at his interpretation, and then look at this, and let's talk what that all means.
Sounds good.
All right.
Thank you.